This podcast may contain language that's not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Today, we are going over 2 weeks' notice. So if you haven't seen it and don't want us to ruin it for you, you might want to pass on this one and come back to us in 2 weeks. I'm just kidding. Next time.
Are you ready
for One Dry Kiss?
Welcome to One Dry Kiss, our cussy, irreverent love letter to rom-coms, where we, in the month of September, have movies for a September to remember, because we're going to New York. Woot, 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 woot. And today we're doing 2 weeks' notice, which coincidentally happens to be in New York. And I am here with my lovely co-host, who was kind enough, out of the goodness of her heart, to bring me a change of scenery. She's recording from the pee-pee closet.
Don't. Oh, it's out there.
Yep. Miss Tamara Cofield.
Guess I got to explain that one. And I am here with my TMI friend, Corinne. I was going to say some nice things about you, but not anymore. Yeah. So I guess an explanation is in order. I spent the night at my friend Larry's house, and I have been spending some time over here. When I come over here, I bring Miss Melody, also known as Miss Melope, because of her age and accidents. And she has pretty much peppered this closet with potty, which was good, I guess, because it was contained, but essentially started stanking up his clothes, and he had to throw away quite a few blankets. He lives on a busy street. I'm at his house. I'm recording, and the quietest place that I could find where we wouldn't get a lot of background noise was in the closet that incidentally still smells a little bit like pee, but hopefully will not after I borrow somebody's rug cleaner. So, yeah. Yep, that's where I'm at.
Yay! Mm-hmm. The things you do for our gentle listeners.
Uh-huh. I'm braving the potty closet, although I'm pretty much used to Melody's essences, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Joie de Melody.
How you doing, Corinne?
I am doing okay. I made it through the heat wave. I am enjoying this weather. I am bummed that it is going to be downpouring tomorrow because I have a big, very furry dog that I am currently taking care of. And I'm like, I don't, oh gosh, that's going to be fun. Wet dog. You know, nothing about that. Yeah. Yeah. Wet dog.
At all. No.
So yeah, I'm going to have a good time with the great Galumph. That's what I call him. His name is Buster and he totally fits that. He's a big pupper.
So Corinne, do you have a synopsis for us?
You know what? I actually wrote one this time.
What?
Uh-huh.
What?
Uh-huh. Yes. I am winning at this game called life. Thank you. Thank you. No applause necessary.
Corinne.
So, Lucy Kelson, played by Sandra Bullock, Harvard-educated lawyer and community activist, is living an exercise in futility as she protests to prevent her beloved community buildings from being torn down, only to have them be torn down, mainly by Wade Enterprises. Boo! She decides to take a different tact to save her neighborhood's community center and approaches the builder, George Wade. The George Wade, who has just been given a talking to by his older brother, as they just lost a deal because of George's beautiful but incompetent head lawyer who went to Princess Cruz's Law School. When Lucy and George meet, they end up making a deal. Lucy will work for George, and George will save the community center. However, their relationship ends up being a bit different than either expects, until Lucy, fed up, gives her 2 weeks' notice. Bow, 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 bow. Will Lucy feel inspired to go back to school, this time at Princess Cruz's Law School? Will George end up quitting his job to work in the community center he saved? And really the most important question, will Lucy and George end up finding love? Keep those listening ears listening to find out. Oh, and George is played by,
Hugh Grant.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready to get us started on the journey that is 2 weeks' notice?
I am. I have my resume in. I'm calling for an interview. Here we go. We open with a lovely montage of Lucy Kelson and George Wade's childhood photos throughout the years. Lucy's photos show that she was a daughter of hippie parents and activists, while George was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. After the montage, we see Lucy squaring off with a wrecking ball and a whole construction crew. They are trying to tear down the community center, but not on Lucy's watch. It's a landmark. She is sitting on top of the wrecking ball like Miley Cyrus before her infamous video. Her friends Meryl and Tom pry her off the ball, and she hollers at the foreman about constitutional rights. She's an attorney and thinks the theater is a landmark and needs to be preserved. The foreman says, "How about this for constitutional rights?" He raises the ball and aims it at the building, and the three of them grab their yoga mats, wet wipes, sunblock, and lay down in front of the machine. Inexplicably, Tom asks Meryl to marry him on the floor in front of the construction crew, and she says, "Yes."
Yay.
How romantic, I guess. The crew stops, the machine shuts off, and Lucy thinks they have prevailed. But they call her a crazy lady as we hear the police sirens sound in the distance. And, of course, they get arrested. We see them next coming out of the police station. The lovebirds and Lucy get bailed out by Lucy's parents. Meryl and Tom rush away to celebrate their newfound union, and Lucy promises to pay her parents back. They pshaw. What are parents for if not to bail their kids out of jail? She asks if they tore down the building after all, and her parents' silence says it all. "Why is nobody responding to me?" she complains. They inform her that Wade Enterprises, which is the faceless behemoth property company, is going to eventually not only tear down the community theater, but their beloved community center. Mm. Lucy's appalled and goes home to drown her sorrows in copious amounts of Chinese food.
And when Tamara says copious amounts of Chinese food, she means copious amounts of
copious
of Chinese food. Lucy comes home to her tiny apartment and listens to a message from her boyfriend, Ansel. If we can really call him her boyfriend, sort of like one of those "my boyfriend lives in Canada" kind of situations. He apologizes. "I'm sorry, but I'm not going to make it back for your birthday." You see, Ansel has a higher calling, one that transcends the relationship with Sandra Bullock, a.k.a. Lucy, and it's called Greenpeace. Lucy isn't surprised. She knows that while she can depend on Ansel to be there for the whales, and I'm guessing a cute Greenpeace volunteer, she knows that she can't depend on Ansel to be there for her. But what she can depend on, Mr. Wong's Chinese food.
I even wrote down her order. Did you write down her order?
Number 17 and number 7. Number 4, no garlic sauce. 2 orders of number 26. 2 number 8s. That's a lot of Chinese food. That's a lot of Chinese food.
Chinese food comes in those huge containers that could feed like 3 to 4 people. And she orders so fucking many. I hate to say it, but what, does she ever have a tapeworm or is she bulimic? I don't want to speculate, but Jesus Christ.
Well, that's basically what I say in my script. Not the tapeworm, but I say that something that this movie doesn't address is that Lucy might have a pretty serious eating disorder or be ordering food for the entire week. But that much food is really for the entire month because that's a lot of Chinese food.
That's a lot of Chinese.
Yeah. She eats her Chinese food alone while reading an article about George Wade. Meanwhile, George is living the high life. He's accepting a Man of the Year award. During his acceptance speech, George posits that he may be receiving the award for the millions that Wade Industries has given towards the hospital's new pediatric wing. Or maybe it's because when he had an appendix out recently, under the influence of drugs, he proposed to all the male and female nurses in the hospital. Winning! He effortlessly schmoozes during the party, reveals that he thinks pediatric has to do with feet, and is ultimately interrupted by his driver, who tells him his brother wants to see him. He goes to his brother Howard's posh mansion and talks to Howard. Why he couldn't have had this conversation on the phone is beyond me. I'm guessing it was a power play, but Howard is pissed. They lost the West Side waterfront deal because George's attorney forgot to file an environmental impact report. George tries to soothe his brother. "You're absolutely right. That's why I fired her." Howard gives him the eye. "You didn't fire her. I did."
just like I fired Debbie from What's the Matter You Law School and Stephanie from St. Bart's Law School. For the love of all that's good in this world, hire an attorney from Yale, Columbia, or at least one who went to an accredited school in the United States. He emphasizes the importance of hiring someone who knows how to file briefs, not just take off George's briefs. George has gotten the message.
I love some of the one-liners in this movie. They're so fucking awesome. Awesome. The next day, the hunt for a new competent attorney begins for George. He walks out of the Wade Enterprises building with an attractive blonde. She's Russian. He just interviewed her, and she tells him how fun that was. Lucy is waiting on the sidelines and seizes the opportunity. She rushes up to speak to George. She tells him she's an attorney, and he asks if she heard of Saint-Tropez Law School. Saint-Tropez tan. You remember that tanning lotion?
No, but I love that jingle. Oh, my God.
Saint-Tropez tan. I forgot the rest of it, but it was in a brown bottle and made you just as brown as the brown bottle. It was amazing. Before the need for sunscreen. Anyways, he asks if she's heard of Saint-Tropez Law School. She has not. He mumbles, shame, because that's probably where his recent interviewee attended. Lucy begins trying to sell him on the importance of her community center. He takes a look at her gorgeous face and asks, hey, where did you go to school? She says Harvard, and then he realizes she's that Lucy Kelson, the one that thwarts his construction projects. He starts getting a little nervous because she attacked the Zeldman brothers, but she scoffs, I did not. It's not my fault they walked under a protest sign. She placates him by showing him more photos of the community center she's trying to save and talking about the benefits of it to the community. CPR classes, water aerobics, preferably not at the same time. The list goes on and on. He politely listens, tells her that Trump has the inside track and tries to excuse himself, but he's not going to get away that easy. Lucy informs him that she knows the assemblyman that can guarantee him the contract as long as he promises to save their community center. He asks, why me? And she admits that she can't get in to see Trump, and the Zeldman brothers have a restraining order against her. Suddenly, his executive assistant races out. They need a quote for Public Policy magazine. He begins a meandering thought about how architecture should inspire people and engage the community. Lucy chimes in about how the community center engages the community and brings people together. They simultaneously have a conversation / pitch, and through it, they spackle together a really great quote for the magazine. Wade realizes there's something there and invites Lucy into his car. She does, under the guise that she could convince him further, but instead he tells her he needs something else from her. In the back seat, she declines because she knows who he is and what reputation he has, and she is not that type of girl. He looks at her confused as she explains, waving her hand in front of her tatas and saying, you know, sex. I am not sleeping with you. He chuckles. Well, although that would be nice, I actually wanted to offer you a job. I actually need chief counsel for Wade Enterprises. Her face falls and she says, I think I'd prefer the sex. He promises if she takes the position, he'll save her community center and she'll have millions of dollars at her disposal to donate to whatever charity she wants. They stop at a hotel and he gets out because he lives there. His life is kind of like Monopoly, and Lucy is stuck in the car contemplating his offer.
$250,000.
Oh, yeah. I left that out because it stung so bad. I was like, you should get... And an executive apartment and a really generous year-end bonus.
$250,000 in 2002. $250,000.
That hurts. That's why I left it out, Corinne. I did not want to reiterate that to myself or the audience because what's the equivalent of that? Do you know what? Don't even tell me.
I couldn't look it up. I couldn't bear it. But I will say, regardless, $250,000 now? Yes, please. I would like to make that much money. Thank you very much.
You might actually be able to afford a home if you make $250,000 in the Bay Area.
Yeah, you might actually be able to make the payments. Lucy contemplates the offer while Pave Paradise, Put Up a Parking Lot plays in the background. She goes to the community center she's trying to save and watches all the people that benefit from it. Then she has a lunch with her parents, talking over it with them. Her mom isn't happy about it at all, but her dad is all in.
Keep your friends close and your enemies closer, he says. Lucy insists that the job isn't going to change me and I'll be able to direct charitable giving. I mean, honestly, that's a pull in itself, is that he's like, all of our charitable giving money, you can say where it goes. And I'm like, yes, please.
Ugh. I just got a lady boner. I also wonder if she would have some say-so in some of the projects that they do. Like, I kind of thought about that after the fact. Like, yes, you're working for Wade Enterprises. Yes, they're a faceless corporation that is all driven by profits. But if you were their chief counsel, could you potentially, like, steer some of their acquisitions towards more environmentally friendly things or something that would preserve something versus something that wouldn't? And vice versa, et cetera, vice versa, yeah. And et cetera, et cetera.
I don't know how much power she has, but it's Lucy. And I have no doubt about Lucy and her just power as a human being, as an energizer rabbit of a human being.
Yeah, seriously. I don't have that energy or that stamina to be as forceful as she is about the rights that she believes in.
2 weeks later, she's walking through Wade Industries like a boss bitch when she sees George in the hall, stops him to talk some business, and he acknowledges what she says and swiftly changes the topic. Sure, I'll meet with you later about those reports, but first, I've got a very important question to ask. Which do you like better? He holds up two nearly identical large envelopes. Lucy isn't impressed. What do you mean? They're the same. George, no. One has a linen finish and the other is a watermarked vellum finish. Watermarked with the tears of the child laborers who made it.
That's how you really know it's handmade.
Yeah.
The tears tell you it's legit.
Each one different. You can get a DNA sample. to find out
which factory your envelope came from. Wait, was that Paco? Did Paco make that envelope? Oh, he does good work. Cries a lot, but that boy's talented.
Lucy responds, okay, well, ignoring the fact that neither are made from recycled paper and you're probably killing a rainforest to make them, she grabs envelope number one and licks the seal, then envelope number two. And licks the seal. She pauses for a moment, tasting her tongue, and then points definitively to envelope number one. This one, it tastes better. George is taken aback. He tastes the envelopes, stunned. You know, I've asked 30 people the same question, and you're the only one who has come up with that answer. You're good. I'm getting you a larger office.
That was my favorite part of the movie, outside of your comment about the tears of the child when no one's around. But if somebody asked me a question that's kind of complicated, I'd be like, what would Lucy do?
What would Lucy do? Order a crap ton of Chinese food. That's what Lucy would do.
I just meant because of her way to think outside the box. Like, no, I just totally agree. That was just like, oh, fuck. Yes. Yes! So that part of the movie really resonated with me.
Little does Lucy realize the Pandora's box she's opened by answering that one question. Mwah! Mm-hmm.
Scared.
This moment brought to you by October, our Halloween-y month. So, yes.
Yes, Halloween-y. Every movie has a hot dog in it.
But 6 months later, she fully does realize the Pandora's box she's opened as George and Lucy are in a mattress store trying out different mattresses because he needs her help picking out a mattress. Fuck it. He needs her help picking out everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
4 months after that, he calls her in the middle of the night. He needs a chat, but instead of chatting with him, she tells him to give the phone to his date. You see, George and his date are in a club, and his date, not the most compelling person, so, you know, who to turn to but Lucy to talk to instead, obviously.
Yeah, I didn't quite get that part. I'm like, if you're trying to hook up with this girl and she seems a little vacant and kind of just like, but into you, and he's that kind of guy, like, why would he call Lucy? Is he unconsciously trying to get out of the booty call, or like, I didn't get that. Like, I know that he relies on her for everything, but I thought based on her exterior and how she is that he probably wouldn't, because of what happens next.
Well, I would say that, yeah, he could have taken the lady to Pound Town, but he's sort of like a dilettante. He's just like, oh, bored now. I need to be entertained. And this woman is not cutting it for me. I'm going to call Lucy and have her entertain me. And then she does, as Tamara says, what happens next? She asks George to hand the phone over to the date. And George surprisingly does. Lucy tells her, the man you're dancing with is deeply troubled and has a very suspicious rash. Get out of the bar and go reach your potential. The woman leaves, and is George relieved? Lucy tells him to go home. They have to handle his divorce the next day. George tries extending the conversation. Yes, we should talk about that. Do you think I should cry? No, George, you shouldn't cry. She tells him to go to bed and she'll see him tomorrow.
That touched me because, Corinne, you know how many times I call you and like, okay, I need to have this difficult conversation. So if I talk to the person, should it be like hiccuping cries? Like, or should it just be like outright like stoic conviction with tears streaming down my face? Or...
yeah, number two, but I would say also, no, just give me the phone and I will tell them what's what.
Oh, God. That's actually really good advice, because I can't have hard conversations without crying. It's like my kryptonite, and I absolutely hate it.
Here's what you do. You put the phone on speaker, and then you just kind of open your mouth, and I will talk.
Are you going to Serrano that shit? Yeah. Is that a thing? Is that Paratrap or Serrano?
Serrano. Yeah. I'm going to put those words in your mouth, literally, because they'll be mine.
No, I'm definitely not going to do it. Okay. The next day at the mediation office, George is running late. Lucy nervously taps her pencil, and across from her sits George's ex-wife and her attorney. They are annoyed, either at the tapping or his tardiness. George finally arrives, and Lucy advises him, don't say anything without checking with me first. They're there to discuss the specifics of the prenuptial agreement. George's ex wants double the alimony because of his infidelity. What infidelity? Lucy asks. The ex informs the room that she found George having sex with another woman in their own bed. He shrugs and counters, well, I did it because you were always so worried about getting stuff on the couch. This enrages her, and she begins shouting, how dare you? But Lucy calmly cuts her off. If infidelity warrants twice the alimony, then conversely, if the ex Mrs. Wade had an affair, that would call for a reduction, correct? We both know that Mrs. Wade had a little couch time of her own with the company attorney, and he is willing to testify in court. George nods smugly beside her. We have very loyal employees. I think it's the medical benefits. Lucy agrees. Yes, yes, great benefits. And then begins outlining the new alimony agreement that she drew up, but George cuts her off. We'll pay you double the alimony, plus a generous property settlement, and $100,000 if you just sign one of those disclosure agreements that releases me from any further obligation. For some reason, because that sounds like a damn good deal, this incenses his wife even more, and she starts shouting, Lucy, says Miss Wade, I'm going to need you to calm down, and this sets her off even more. How dare you call me Mrs. Wade? You're just one of his dumb bimbos. George argues that she's not dumb, but doesn't say anything about the bimbo, as she picks up a glass of water and throws it in Lucy's face. Lucy is a bit of a germaphobe and starts flailing because some water went up her nose! George takes out a very nearly clean hanky and tends to her, lightly dabbing her face.
When he's like, this is a very nearly clean hanky, I was like, no, back away from that hanky! Don't want at all!
I think he was just saying that to fuck with her, because like if water went up my nose, I'd be like, ah, shit, and kind of snort it out. But she's like, water up my nose. I'm like, I would take water up the nose over the very nearly clean hanky. God knows what he did with it any day of the week.
Yeah.
After the meeting, divorces make George hungry, so out on the street, he stops by a vendor to get a meat kebab. Lucy is upset because he folded on the alimony, and she just wants to do her job, if he'll let her. He's dumbfounded and says, "You always want me to give money to those less fortunate." But she argues, "Everyone's less fortunate than you, George, and I prefer you give the money to somebody needy, not somebody who's going to spend it all on collagen." He leaves the vendor with a $100 bill, telling him to keep the change, and heads down the street. She follows after him, sees a disheveled man holding a cup, and promptly drops some change into it because she can't be outdone on the charity front. "Hey," the guy says, "you jerk, you just put change in my coffee." She apologizes profusely. "I'm sorry, I thought you were needy." George is tickled at this exchange, and she huffs, "Is anybody not going to attack me today?" He says, "I'm probably not, but I do need your help with something else." We next see them in a posh department store. He's holding out a belt and asks her, "Is this tawdry or beltacular?" She could give a shit about the belt.
I did not realize he said either of those things. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think you're beltacular, Tamara.
You should have put that at the top instead of telling everybody I was in a pee-pee closet. Tamara's beltacular. She is not sitting in her own dog's filth for the sake of the listeners. Anyways, Lucy could give a shit about the belt. "I'm a lawyer, George," she reminds him. He can tell that she's upset. "Why don't we get away," he offers, "somewhere where people don't know how much money I have." "Where is Staten Island, by the way?" "We could go there. You could pretend to be my spinster sister and help me find a new wife. Doesn't that sound fun?" "It doesn't." She yells, "Harvard doesn't give a degree in Yenta." "I'm a lawyer and a good one. I just want to do my job, not help you pick out your belts or help you find your next wife. I demand respect." George says he does respect her. He has nothing but respect. R-E-S-P-E-C-T. This, of course, offends her, and she leaves in a huff. In a huff!
2 months later, Lucy is standing at the altar as the maid of honor for Meryl and Tom's wedding. They are in the middle of their vows when Lucy's motherfucking phone rings. And instead of turning it off...
I know. This was her bad.
She reads a text from George.
Oh, yeah.
"Emergency! Come ASAP!" Mom. She excuses herself and runs out in the middle of the motherfucking ceremony. And Tamara, if you did that to me, there would be a lot of hard feelings and words. We would have words later.
No. No. Hey, okay. Oh, where do I start? Turn off your fucking phone.
Yes.
Yes, you have a demanding, very needy boss. Turn off your phone. How long is the ceremony going to be? 45 minutes? You're not Catholic, right? 45 minutes at the most. Then if you do get a text, like if you say you have it on vibrate because there's a really like important deal, like put your phone on vibrate, see the text. Guess what? I'll call you back in a half an hour when I'm done here.
And just keep it in your panties. That way you'll also get a little excitement while you're waiting.
That. And I now pronounce, "Oh, you husband, oh my god, oh, somebody's really trying to get a hold of me. They're calling a lot. Thank you, Jesus." And then don't leave the fucking ceremony. That was just, out of as much as I love Lucy as a character, that's the one time I was like, what the fuck, Lucy? Come on. Meryl's your best friend since you guys were girls and brownies. Come on. You're better than that.
For real. I think she just gets so singularly focused on whatever she feels like the priority is that. But I'm like, girl, the priority is your bestie's wedding. That's the priority.
Yes. Yes. Even though she did put you in a Pepto-Bismol pink dress, she's still your best friend.
You can put me in a Pepto-Bismol pink dress and it will just match my complexion and I'll look like I'm naked.
No. I was like, that's just cruel. I would not put you in a Pepto-Bismol pink. You are, nope.
So she excuses herself and runs out in the middle of the ceremony, hops into the first available cab, and tries calling George, freaking out about the possibility of permits not going through. She runs through the Grand Hotel lobby and by this point knows all the employees, and they all greet each other as she hustles through. She gets to George's hotel room. "George?" George responds desperately. "I'm over here. I'm in my closet." Lucy rushes in and turns out he needs help choosing an outfit because he's judging the Miss New York pageant in an hour.
Fucker.
Yeah. It's televised and it's important that he look good.
Fucker.
Yeah. Lucy is livid. "I ran out of a wedding because you said it was an emergency," George is baffled. Why in the fuck would you run out of a wedding for me? Lucy responds.
We all want to know, George. We all want to know.
Seriously. You said it was an emergency. Now, I've gone over this with you before. What constitutes an emergency? George responds. A meteor, extreme blood loss, and... I don't remember the third. Lucy reminds him. Death! And you are not dead! As she picks out his entire outfit, she ticks off just some of the times he's done this. This is just like when you called me at 3 a.m. because you had a nightmare about being the 5th member of KISS, or when you busted into my gynecologist appointment to pick which headshot to use for the cover of People. I'm done.
That's grounds for a goddamn lawsuit right there. Oh.
This past weekend, I had a conversation with my mom. One, we went to get our booster shots, and then she was like, oh, my phone is on vibrate. Somebody's calling me, and it's in my fanny pack right against my pubic bone. Two.
My God.
I was like, overshare, Mom, overshare. Two, we're talking about this appointment, and... she's talking about the speculum, and I'm like, it's a speculum. And she's like, no, it's not. And I'm like, yeah, that's a speculum. And she's like, no, the speculum is the swabs that they use to take, or like the little pinchy things they use to take skin samples. I'm like, no, that's not a speculum. The speculum is what you put inside of you. And she's like, and it spreads you apart. And she's like, mm-hmm. She looks it up. Oh, you're right. Yes, I'm right. I know what a fucking speculum is.
When's the last time your mom went to a lady doctor appointment, and how confused is she when they say they're going to use a speculum on her?
I know, because they're like, the awesome thing about gynecologists is that they are like, and now I'm going to warm up and insert the speculum into you. It's not like it, like they name everything before it happens. Oh, mama.
So when your mama sees that thing headed towards her, does she just think they're taking like a really big sample or something?
She's like, I didn't sign up for live action Pac-Man. I'm sorry, I'm leaving.
Oh, God. Oh, that just hurt my cooch.
Lucy emphasizes, I'm done. She thrusts two ties towards him, one banana yellow and the other a royal purple. George picks the royal purple one and asks, excuse me? Lucy coolly says, please consider this my 2 weeks' notice. George responds, well, I find you ungrateful. You get an apartment, a fat-free muffin basket every morning, and if you didn't want to deal with these after-hours issues, you'd turn off your phone, but you don't. I think you thrive on this, and you like feeling needed. And I gotta say, as much as I'm not for him being defensive and shit like that, I do think he has a point about her not having the boundaries and turning off her fucking phone.
Mm-hmm. And then blaming him for, well, I mean, what's him calling her? And also, just sidebar that doesn't have anything to do with this conversation in hand, why is she eating a fat-free muffin basket if she hoovers Chinese food like it's her last meal on Earth?
Well, she's got to keep herself regular and cleansed. I've been listening to this podcast about the F factor diet, which is like fiber.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically like you ingest like a crap ton of fiber. So you're...
And then you crap a crap ton?
Yeah, then you crap a crap ton. You're shitting all the time.
Fun.
And, you know, so she's just making sure that she gets everything cycling through.
No. Nope. I'm going to bind myself up to release everything, to bind myself up again to release everything.
Lucy is frustrated. Fine. You're right. This is my fault. I've managed to turn myself into this. There's not even a name for it. George agrees. Consider how I feel. Before you came along, I was able to make decisions on my own, and now I can't. I can't make a single decision without you. You've broken me. Oh, George, fuck off. The next day, Lucy tries finding a new job, but every single place she interviews with turns her down. George Wade has made sure that no one will hire her. Lucy is pissed. She goes to George's office, where he's getting a massage, and directs the therapists not to forget to massage his cloven hoof. George gets up from his massage, flipping the massage table back into the wall, where it looks like a wooden wall panel,
mm-hmm.
and reminds her of the contract she drafted, and that she says, she will work for Wade Enterprises until Island Towers is complete, and it's not. He accuses her of wanting to stay on, which is why she drafted such a great contract. Okay, at this point in the movie, over his shoulder in his fucking office, there is this picture in his office where I'm like, how in the hell does he get... He has this picture of this woman who's like scantily clad on her hands and knees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in his fucking office. And it just seems like a really odd place for it. Oh, and he's got a towel wrapped around his waist. Okay, there we go.
Mm. Oh, was she on all fours?
She is on all fours in a strapless black dress.
Okay, and there's somebody with some knee-high boots standing behind her.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, wow.
I know. It's a very odd picture from many regards, and definitely not one I would have in an office like that.
Is it Prime Video where you could see like the captions and like the fun facts on the side?
Yeah.
I wish we were watching Prime. It was like, that's what's her name? Fucking a famous photographer.
Yeah,
it's supposed like, to be a remake.
That's Annie Leibovitz's photograph. Yeah, photograph. That's great. Yes, photograph.
Maybe the photograph is a bootleg of her photograph. That's much cheaper, but still pretty good quality.
So Lucy calls her parents for counsel, and they agree that her contract is ironclad. Her mom gives her shit for taking the job, and her dad is very impressed with the airtight contract she made. And he says the only way out of it is to do a bad job and get fired. Lucy, given that idea by her dad, now has an idea.
Oh. And the next day, she's scheduled to meet with George and his brother Howard at Wade Enterprises. She sticks a huge wad of gum in her mouth while she walks into the building. The guys are in Howard's very fancy, very posh, very oaky office waiting because she's 45 minutes late. She comes in, lounges on the couch as Howard informs her that he wants to do some promoting for the Coney Island build. Lucy dismissively picks up a framed picture and says, "Howie, are these your kids? I've never met them before. Those are good-looking boys." George informs her that one of the boys is named Sue and not a boy at all. Lucy taps the frame and says, "Oh, of course, she's a looker." And George nods and slowly says, "No, that's not Sue, that's Paul." Howard, irritated, takes the frame from her and continues on. As he's talking, he walks, passing in front of a waste paper basket, just as Lucy attempts to spit her gum into it. Hatoy! Misses, and Howard inadvertently steps in it. He looks at her appalled, and she just smiles. Uh-oh. Okay, thought my phone was dying because I heard a ding.
Oh, I thought it was vibrating between your legs and you were just feeling something very special.
Call back. Please call back. Howard hobbles on one leg and attempts to remove the gum from the bottom of his shoe. George, he says, "Do you have any ideas for the promotion?" He tries to mask the irritation in his voice. George looks at Lucy because this is usually when she chimes in and gives him the ideas that he can take credit for, but she just nods at him and says, "Hiya." After the meeting, he takes her by the elbow and ushers her into a restroom. He knows what she's trying to do. Pathetic attempt to do a bad job and get fired. Not at this company, not at Wade Enterprises. But Lucy is frazzled and informs him that she has an ulcer. She doesn't sleep well at night, and I think about you constantly in the shower. He smirks suggestively. Not like that. Not in a good way. In a way that I'm so distracted I can't remember if I wash my hair, so I wash my hair twice. He promises not to call after hours anymore, but she knows that's a lie. She pleads, "I have a hole in my stomach and I'm running out of shampoo and today's the first day that I did not give 1,000% at my job and I hate that feeling." Mm. To which George finally relents. "Fine, find somebody to replace you and then you can go off and get a job wherever you want." She hugs him enthusiastically saying, "Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you." As they break apart, there's some feelings between them, but it's short-lived because, did you see that? They kind of had a look when they were hugging in the bathroom. And it was like, oh, a little deep, a little long, a little involved.
A heart eyes, perhaps?
A little heart in the eyes, yeah. Yeah, a
little boop, 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 winky, winky.
But it's short-lived because George's cufflink falls. She bends to pick it up and unintentionally gets her hair caught in his belt. His beltacular belt. They try to pull apart, just as Howard walks in the restroom and sees Lucy on her knees next to George's crotch. They try to play it off as if they're brainstorming for a photo opportunity, but Howard doesn't buy it. He has seen his little brother in this position before. Lucy and George manage to break apart, with Howard looking on disapprovingly. The next day at the groundbreaking ceremony, George and Lucy are in an empty dirt pit. There's a dismal attendance by the press. George poses for a few publicity photos and asks if they can leave already, and Lucy agrees, but first she wants to go say hello to her parents and hustles off to the edge of the building's site fence. George follows closely after her because they've been working together this whole time and he's never met her parents. He introduces himself, and Lucy's mom, Ruth, scowls at him. He sits there for a few uncomfortable beats and mumbles, "Well, I can certainly see where Lucy gets her stare from." But before Larry, Lucy's dad takes pity and introduces himself and says hello. George thanks both of them for their support on the build, and they assure him that they don't support the build. He only got it because he's keeping the community center. Larry invites Lucy back home for a piece of cake, and she declines. And George is surprised that they actually live in this area. He wants to see where Lucy grew up, so they all decide to head over to the Rents house. As they're walking, Ruth asks if he would reconsider not building the Coney Island Towers, but he regrettably can't turn away $50 million in profits. She chastises him, "How can you sleep at night?" And he admits that he has a machine that simulates the sound of the ocean. Much to Lucy's dismay, he is not helping himself in her parents' eyes. Once they get to the Kelsons' house, Lucy takes George up to the roof, which was her special place growing up. George nods and says every kid needs a special place. Mine was a small one-bedroom on Park and 91st. Lucy laughs as he adds, "It wasn't much, but we were happy." The view from the roof is spectacular, overlooking Coney Island and the beach. She tells him about how at night the block would come alive, the dad sitting on one side, the mom sitting on the other, and the kids riding their bikes in between. She would sit up there alone, thinking about the most recent argument she had with her mother, who regrettably is still the voice in her head. "Yes," George agrees, "she's terrifying. I thought she was going to kill me and feed me to the poor." She laughs. "Yes, she always challenged me, never get a B when you can get an A." George is awestruck. "You once got a B?" She shakes her head, "theoretically speaking." "There are worse things," he adds, "like not having anyone have any expectations for you at all." She looks at him seriously. There's a glob of frosting on the corner of his mouth, and she delicately swipes it away. He looks at her and says, "There's something amuck with this cake." And she chuckles and admits that it is made out of tofu.
Ugh.
Ew. Ew. Ew, ew, ew.
Nope, nope, nope. Nope, 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 tofu. Nope, 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 nope. No
so
tofu.
Cancel the tofu fat-free muffin basket that I ordered for you.
Yes, please. I'll have some tofu in my Chinese food, but no tofu fat-free muffin basket. Also no fat-free
Fine.
Muffins, please. Nope, yeah. Nope, nope, nope. They just don't taste good. Nope.
If you mention fat-free muffins, Corinne gets caught on repeat saying no.
Nope, 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 nope.
The next morning, Lucy and George conduct interviews for her replacement. However, George is an HR liability waiting to happen. The first interviewee is Polly St. Clair. Tamara laughs because she knows it's true. At previous interviews, he probably asked, like, So, that's an awfully nice looking outfit. What size do you wear?
Yeah. No, he says that, like, when they're walking out in the initial scene with the Saint-Tropez lawyer girl. He's like, "Oh, you're Russian, right? I can tell. Blonde hair, blue eyes." And I'm like, "Dude, back away, 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 back away."
George looks up from Polly's resume and says, "Your resume looks great and congratulations on the baby." I'm like, "You know, Tamara, what I never do?
Never?
I never say anything to anyone about the possibility that they might be having a baby until they say something to me. I don't care if they look like they're 9 months pregnant and in maternity wear. I keep my mouth shut and I just pretend like that's not happening because who knows? Who the fuck
right, Lisa?
Knows? Yeah,
absolutely. I can back up that point because when I was going to see my ex in the hospital, one morning, I walked up to the check-in booth and there was a man standing there. He was pretty slight, but he turned around and he had the biggest, roundest, most protruding belly. I think he probably had a tumor because it was like he was 8.5 to 9 months pregnant, but I'm pretty sure he wasn't because he was a man. But I mean, like, if somebody legit had that same condition as him, or say, like, a woman had that same legit condition as him, and somebody said, are you pregnant? No, I just have this growth that I need to get taken out of me. Thanks for asking, though.
Yeah, and sometimes people hold weight in weird ways. There are, like, trans men who do get pregnant and give birth, but yeah.
I'm pretty sure he was not a trans man. I'm fairly 90% confident that he was not. Because I thought that, too. I was like, maybe he's a... Nope, I'm guessing that's probably a condition that he has.
Yeah. And I've definitely dated guys who have the pregnant belly going on. But, yeah. So, I just, like, I don't care. Just keep my mouth shut about it until they say something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or there's a head protruding from their hoo-ha.
Right.
Oh, you're pregnant. Okay.
Let me get some clean towels for you. Okay.
And hot water. They always seem to need hot water for whatever reason. I'll go get that too.
Yeah. We got a great hot water dispenser in our office now, so it'll be perfect. Yeah, because...
Wow.
So, Polly looks at him irately. What baby? Lucy whispers to George. Maybe you should check with me before you talk. Polly presses. What baby? Lucy tries shifting the topic. I'd like to talk to you about your moot court experience, but Polly is not letting it go. What baby? George turns to Lucy. Yeah, what baby? Interview disaster? Check. After that disaster, they go to lunch. They both order the same meal, but George automatically gives Lucy the majority of the ice from his cup, and Lucy takes the crispy crunchies from the top of his salad, and he takes the beets from hers. They are in a serious groove with each other. Over lunch, George once again insists on a woman being hired because it aggravates his brother. The next day at work, George comes into Lucy's office wearing his tennis gear for a charity tennis event later and asks her, does this outfit make me look like Bjorn Borg? And Bjorn Borg is a hottie of the tennis world from the 70s and early 80s. And I have no idea how he was perceived in the early aughts, but Lucy doesn't care. She casually, not casually, mentions that her and Ansel got into a fight and they're broken up. He wants her to go on a Greenpeace boat, and she can't help it if she doesn't like boats. Throughout this, she's decisively stapling papers together until she gets a little carried away with a stapler, pounding it multiple times to staple some papers. George rescues the stapler and queries, "You don't like all boats?" And the next thing we know, George has taken her to a yacht to cheer her up and to show her hashtag not all boats are bad. Lucy, secured in a life jacket and super drunk, rambles to George about her disastrous love life and how she doesn't know what she's doing wrong. George suggests she be more feminine. Ugh. And Lucy responds very similarly to me. I'm not gonna change myself up for some guy unless I'm really into him. Maybe it's just that I'm bad in bed. George agrees. Maybe you are. Lucy scoffs. I am like a bobcat. I can make myself into a pretzel. You do not need 4th of July fireworks when you sleep with me, because I am the entire show. She eyes him and jabs a finger at him. Because that's what men want. That's what you want. She pokes him in the chest and then plants a kiss on him. It is dry. There's no movement. But for the love of all that is good in the world, she holds and holds and holds that kiss a bit longer and then passes out. George is a gentleman, takes her home, and puts her on the couch to sleep it off, gently placing a pillow under her head while she snores.
The next morning, Lucy has a hangover and doesn't remember the previous evening. She's sitting outside in a courtyard when George approaches her and asks, "Nothing happened between us, right?" He looks her into the eyes and says, "You made noises I've never heard anybody make before." She's not entirely convinced about what he says and asks, "We didn't. We didn't, did we?" He's intentionally elusive for a few beats, but admits, "No, not physically, but spiritually, you're the best I ever had." She apologizes for anything she said or didn't say, and they both look a little regretful. Is it because they did or didn't do anything? He says he has work to do, gets up, and tells her to relax. She nods and says, yeah, see you later. A little while later, she's in the break room getting a cup of coffee when the executive assistant, Norman, comes in and tells her there's a June Carver here to see her. He says it rather loud and startles her, and she spills coffee all down the front of her shirt. He says, Jesus, be careful, and hands her a folder. June went to Harvard, doesn't have an appointment, but was hoping to speak to you for a few minutes. Lucy peruses the resume while simultaneously batting away Norman's attempts to try to help her wipe the coffee off her tatas. She huffs and heads to her office, reluctantly agreeing to meet with the potential candidate. While behind her desk, she's approached by a very attractive redhead who apologizes for being so forward and coming in without an appointment. It's June. She immediately starts flattering Lucy. You are a legend at Harvard and an inspiration to a lot of us. Editor of the Law Review and all those articles you wrote on the Richmond cases? June picks up her satchel and pulls out an article that Mr. Wade quoted and reads, it sounds stupid that I'm quoting this, but I love this quote. I was like, maybe I say that a little bit better. She picks
up a quotable
and
quote?
Pulls out, it's a quotable quote. She picks up her shush. And pulls out an article that Mr. Wade was cited on and reads, is it stupid that I'm quoting this? When I think about how architecture can shape a community and turn strangers into neighbors, how the right design for a park makes people feel secure, how a school building can be functional and beautiful so kids feel engaged instead of imprisoned. When I read that, I thought I was going to be working for a cause, not just a company. That is the joint quote Lucy and George spackled together on their first meeting. George happens to be listening at the door and after hearing that last bit says, that's it, you're hired. And also, I didn't write that quote, Lucy did. Lucy corrects him, no, actually, you did, and I remember being surprised. See, George says, we've been working together so long we don't know who says what. Norman interrupts. They're about to start the meeting, Lucy, and she excuses herself, telling June that they should set up a formal interview the next day. But George intervenes. I could take this one and finish up the interview here. Lucy's taken aback. You're not coming to the meeting, she asks. Have I ever? He counters. She gets his point and goes to leave, but there's something in that room that she doesn't like. She pops her head back in and asks, are we still on for the baseball game tonight? But he never answers, because June butts in, I love baseball. I'm a Mets fan. And they continue bantering and flirting while Lucy nervously plays with their hair. Or maybe she's just trying to flirtatiously play with their hair. We'll never know. I think there was also a moment, I can't remember if it was this one, that he said something inappropriate to June. He was like, oh, she's a Mets fan. Oh, so you obviously have a active fantasy life. And he's like, oh, you look like you're from an Irish family. So large family, kind of dirty. And I'm like, you just say that Irish people are kind of dirty. He said something to that effect. And like, since we were going on about his inappropriateness during interviews, I was like, oh, beep, back away. I don't know if he says it in that bit, but I know he for sure says, oh, so you're from an Irish family, probably large, a little bit dirty. And I'm like, yeah. Oh, my God, 2002, what have you done?
Oh, 2002, you've done a lot of dirty things.
That night at the baseball game, Lucy and George have front row seats, and she asks him, so, what did you think of June? He said he loved her. She flattered him mercilessly and would have no problem picking out an ottoman, exactly what he needs in an assistant. He also admits that they went out for drinks and talked for hours and that she's really a sharp girl. She doesn't happen to have a place to stay, so he also put her up at the Grand Hotel and is going to come to the company outing with them. Winds up, she's a very useful tennis player. Lucy has a feeling deep down. She's a little jealous, and it's showing. But before she can say anything to confirm that, a baseball flies towards her.
Oh, no.
She.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Frantically bats it away, ruining the play, and everyone in the audience boos her. A Mets player that I'm sure is somebody famous tells her next time to go to a Yankees game. That I didn't write down. The next day at the company outing, George and June are playing tennis doubles against Lucy and Norman at a swanky country club. At first, it's all good-natured. They lob the ball back and forth until June spikes it at Lucy's waist and hits her in the thigh. George and June do a victory high five, but Lucy is incensed. She volleys the ball towards June's feet, and when June can't get it, she gives her a in-your-face look, and it's on between the ladies. They hog the ball, and the doubles game turns into a singles game between the two of them, whacking the ball furiously towards each other until June belts Lucy in the forehead.
Oof.
She falls to the ground, a red welt forming, and everyone rushes over. June seems genuinely concerned and asks if she's okay. She says, quick, ask me something that I know to make sure I don't have a concussion. And George says, okay, who are the name of all the Supreme Court justices? From the floor, Lucy prattles off, Thomas, Ginsburg, Scalia, Stevens, Kennedy, Rehnquist, Souter, Bader, O'Connor. She looks up hopeful. Is that right? To which George shrugs. How should I know? But for safety's sake, she decides to sit out the rest of the game and instead drowns her sorrows in chili dogs and cookies while watching June and George flirt off in the distance.
This next section I call Not Defeated by a Redhead, which is the color of June's hair, but Defeated by Food. After the tennis match, George is giving Lucy a ride home in Lucy's car, and she's not feeling good. The literal, oh shit. Booty clenching, cold sweating, I don't know how much longer I can hold this in, poosplosion feeling.
I just have to say, she gets that rumbling in her tumbly when they're in the country club parking lot. I'm like, you turn that bitch around and say, I'm just going to be in the bathroom for a few minutes. Wait for me. Don't just sit in the car and be like, I'm going to be fine. In New York, where there is more than likely traffic, just saying. You feel a rumbly in your tummy and you're in a parking lot, you go back in and you use the facilities that you know are probably nice and available to you. Another thing where I was like, what the fuck, Lucy? Where's your mind at? Don't answer your phone in wedding ceremonies and use a bathroom when it's convenient and close.
You know, sometimes it sneaks up on you, though. You're like, oh, that's interesting. I feel a little rumbly in my tumbly. And then suddenly you're like, ooh.
And this might be my Pavlovian response to go to the bathroom every time I leave anywhere, because my mom, as I grew up, anywhere we went, me and my sister would be like, you know, she'd ask us if we'd have to go to the bathroom. We'd always say no, of course. And she's like, well, then you go in there and you squeeze. So it's like every time now, surprisingly, if I'm leaving someplace, I'm like, oh, I have to go to the bathroom. And then I have to pause and be like, do I really need to go to the bathroom? Or is it just that Pavlovian response?
I very much have a Pavlovian response as well. But I also know as poosplosions, you can go to the bathroom, you can walk away from the bathroom, and then you can suddenly be hit by the poosplosion feeling. Mm-hmm. I can't help that feeling deep inside deep my sphincter. Sphincter.
No, we are not going to make a soundtrack to the poosplosion. No.
Oh, hooked on a feeling. That poosplosion.
I'm high on believing you need to use facilities when they're available.
George is rambling on about how great June is when he hears Lucy moan next to him. What's wrong? I thought you liked her. Lucy looks intensely uncomfortable. I'm not feeling so well. Maybe it was the extra chili dog, the fries, or the entire bag of cookies I ate. I'm not exactly sure. George tries to distract her with small talk, but it doesn't matter. She's gotta go. Where will Lucy go?
Maybe in her pants. Maybe in the car. Maybe in a Bed Bath & Beyond plastic bag like Kirsten from Let's Go to Court.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. I was like, where's the Bed Bath & Beyond bag? Where's the Bed Bath & Beyond bag? We'll find out after the break. And we're back. When we last left off, Lucy was containing a large poosplosion inside her tiny body. And now we will find out where she will go.
Okay. Yay.
George suggests she go in the car, as they're currently stuck on a ramp in stopped traffic. I don't think he realizes what he's asking for. She refuses. I would have gotten out of the car, opened both doors for a little privacy, and just squatted it out. But George has a better idea. He sees an RV and decides that's the solution. Lucy objects. It doesn't look clean. But George is taking charge, and in the words of Tamara on the outline, I wouldn't give a fuck.
Why would you rather squat in? I mean, if you... Dirty toilet's better than no toilet, in my opinion. I don't care. That's the hill I'm going to die on. Dirty toilet's better than no toilet.
Dirty toilet is better than pooing all over yourself and the car.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Ugh. And in responses to Tamara saying,
a dirty toilet is better than no toilet. And I wouldn't give a fuck.
I say forever and ever amen to that. They dash past the stopped cars to the RV. He knocks on the door and surprisingly, they open it. They're obviously not from around here. Mm-hmm. George offers the family $100 to use the restroom. Lucy interjects, 1,000. The woman says, okay. And while Lucy is in the bathroom moaning in relief, George sits with the family in the RV making small talk. The traffic starts moving, and in one of those live and let live moments, they abandon Lucy's car while they ride in the family's RV, with them ultimately dropping George and Lucy off at a strip mall. And naturally, as frequently happens when dropped at a strip mall without your vehicle, George, as one does, calls for a helicopter to pick them up.
That part just gave me such anxiety because where they had abandoned the car, it was just two lanes.
Yeah.
Opposing traffic, and there was no median.
Yeah.
And they were basically blocking thousands and thousands of cars. And yeah. How long would it be before somebody could actually get there and tow it? Oh, nightmare.
I did not understand that at all. I was like, why is there only two lanes of traffic, one going one way and the other going another way on an obvious kind of freeway rampy type of thing? Mm-hmm. It did not make any sense to me. I totally agree with you. And also, if I were in that position, I'd just be like, I just gotta go.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me out here.
While they wait, George cracks some jokes to make her feel better, and it's delightful seeing the familiar intimacy of their relationship in the helicopter. George marvels about the Chrysler Building, its gorgeous Art Deco style, and Lucy agrees. It's really remarkable. She turns to George. It's amazing what dreams and a lot of money can create. She looks in his eyes. And you know you're part of that. All you have to do is use your power for good. Instead of for evil, he says softly, if only I would. He gazes back at her. I'm sorry for making your life unbearable, but now your 2 weeks is almost up and you can move on. Lucy agrees. Unbearable would have been bearable. And she assures him she's tying up all other loose ends before moving on.
A few days later, June catches George in the break room. She admits that she has a bad case of tennis elbow, and he jokingly says that Lucy has tennis forehead. Well, at least she looks okay, June adds, since you guys are going to that benefit tonight. What's it for again? George explains it's a benefit for the New York Children's League. Lucy gives them lots of money, and it sounds exciting, but it's actually pretty boring. June says boring for you just might be scintillating to a girl from Plainview, Wisconsin, and slowly starts walking away. Well, he invites her along. A bunch of them are going together, and she happily accepts. A little later, June heads into Lucy's office where she is attempting to tie up those loose ends. She has the environmental reports that she asked for. Lucy is pleased and immediately hands her the appraisals to take care of. But June informs her that she doesn't know how much time she has because George invited her to the benefit that night. This is a shock to Lucy, but she tries to mask it by saying, "Great," and then walks away making a pissy face as she leaves. Later that afternoon, she passes George on the landing, hands him a stack of files, and says, "Sign these or we default on 5 loans," and walks away. This is not like her, and he follows her down the stairs, arguing, "You still have to go over my speech with me, for the benefit." But she's got to run. "All right," he tells her they'll pick her up at 8, and she says, "No thanks, I don't need a ride," and hurries out the door, and leaves George lingering behind, wondering what the fuck was that about. On the ride home, George gets a call from Howard, who tells him that they've got the appraisals and can't possibly keep the community center. They're going to have to knock it down. Mm. George argues that they can't because he only got the job by saying they were going to keep the community center. Howard corrects, "We intended to keep the community center, but now it's out of the question." George threatens to sabotage anything going on with that project unless his brother concedes, but Howard is adamant. He accuses George of being out of touch with reality. The economy is bad, and George has a barrage of costly divorces and extravagant parties. He doesn't realize how precarious the company's future is. And if that's not incentive enough, if George doesn't do his job, he will get fired and lose all his stock options. He is the closer, and he needs to close this deal.
The closer.
The closer.
That night at the benefit, it's a black tie circus theme. Of course. Because, you know, naturally, black tie circus theme, ovs.
Of course. Haven't you gone to 2 or 3 of those in your life, at least?
Absolutely. You should see the plethora of designer black gowns I have for such events. Along with crazy hats. Winky, winky. Mm. Yeah.
Fun.
George and June arrive together dressed to the nines, except he has a comically large tie. And Tamara used the word comically large tie, and I will agree with her. But when she said comically large tie, she meant comically large tie. Like it went down to his knees and the bottom part was about the width of his body. So, yeah.
It's funny, though, because in this scene, he also, as you'll probably later say, run into Donald Trump, who also comically has large ties that dangle down to his junk like an arrow that just people talk shit about.
In real life, yes.
Yeah. So I wonder if that was like a nod to Donald Trump and his comically large, low dangling ties that George Wade was like, you think that's low hanging fruit, baby? Look at this. But damn.
And June is wearing a festive top hat. George leaves and runs into Donald Trump. Yeah, why? But George knows that Trump is a walking, talking, overblown, overly sculpted, overly hairsprayed helmet of hair and quickly moves on from him. After that encounter.
Overly tanned. Overly Cheeto colored.
Oh, overly orangely tanned / Cheeto colored. Mm-hmm. Right, overly hairsprayed helmet of hair, and quickly moves on from him.
Yes.
Yeah, great. After that encounter, also seditious bastard, after that encounter, he needs something to soothe his soul. And across the party, he sees Lucy, and she looks fucking radiant. Radiant. That dress is like the Chrysler building of dresses. It's gorgeous. And then I put, like, seriously fucking gorgeous. Yes. Norah Jones sings, it's not the pale moon that excites me, that thrills and delights me. Oh, no. It's just the nearness of you. They wave at each other, smile, nodding, talking with their eyes, and amongst the many people, while standing across the room from each other, they manage to have a really sweet, intimate moment. They meet halfway across the party, and he can't take his eyes off of her. He tells her she looks absolutely stunning, and she adds the final flourish, which is a red clown nose. He responds, normally, that'd fit your outfit just fine, but tonight, he trails off. As he tenderly takes the red nose off her face, she stares at him with hard eyes, and he stares at her wordlessly in wonder. And then comes in June to cockblock.
Of course.
Am I interrupting something? She says, fully fucking knowing that she is fucking interrupting something.
1000%.
Ugh. She's got this whole, who, me? Kind of, like, innocent vibe that she channels while she, literally tromps all over people. It's really not cute. June tells Lucy that Howard said that she would need to revise the Island Tower agreement now that they're knocking down the community center. This is news to Lucy, and she asks to speak to George privately. Once they're alone, she rips into him about not keeping his word. Their argument makes me sad, so I'll summarize. Lucy actually liked him. It's true.
She's gonna Corinne-ize it.
I'm just gonna like close my eyes, you know, and just sort of throw a few words out there. I don't like it when mom and dad fight. Lucy actually liked him until this moment, which is why she put up with all the other bullshit. She wants him to be the man that he can be. George is defensive and says that he hasn't liked himself for a very long time. She doesn't work for him anymore, so she has no say in the matter, and she should go and be the woman she can be. She leaves in a huff.
In a huff! Oh, I scared the dog.
Oh, no. Sorry.
After the benefit, George and June go back to the Grand Hotel. They head up the elevator to their respective rooms, and she gushes, oh, I can't wait to tell my family who I met tonight. He's confused and asks, who? She says quietly, you. On the way up, he makes some polite chit-chat about how her room is, and she says, amazing. They finally arrive to her floor, and she hesitates at the elevator's opening, much to the dismay of the older couple at the back of the car. Ugh. She lingers, telling him she had a wonderful time and gives him a short kiss on the lips. He doesn't pull back, and after a moment, he goes in for a second, longer, lingering kiss as the poor couple punch on the door to close the elevator door buttons to close, close, close. George and June tumble back into the car and are full on making out now. The woman loudly ahems right behind his ear, and he pulls away from the kiss long enough to say, it's okay, I'm the hotel owner and your breakfast is complimentary. This placates them, and they eventually get to George's floor, and June joins him in his hotel room. He offers her a beer, and she notices a game of chess in the corner. She tells him there's only one thing she likes more than chess. George looks at her questioningly and says, "Pokemon?" She says no with pouty lips and admits, "It's strip chess." "Oh, yes," he agrees. "That's a very good game." Meanwhile, Lucy is coming up. She's made her way to George's hotel, and she is not going down without a fight. That is not the Lucy way. Mm-hmm. She barges into George's room unannounced, yelling, "We're not done talking about this in the community center," when she encounters June standing in front of the refrigerator holding two beers and wearing nothing but a bra and a slip and a top hat. They stand there awkwardly for a few moments before George rushes in wearing nothing but a button-up shirt, boxers, one sock, and his enormous gag tie. Lucy realizes what she walked into, and George offers, "We were just playing chess and doing some laundry." Lucy hurries over to the elevator doors, embarrassed, and says, "Oh, no, it's okay. I was just ready to go off and have some sex myself." She stands waiting, open, 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 and adds, "Well, not by myself, but with somebody. Yep, somebody in my bed. Name's Barry. Barry in my bed." The elevator finally comes, and she rushes into it and leaves. Once she hits the ground floor, she goes straight to Meryl's house to give her back her shoes. She tries to hand them off and leave, but Meryl's not letting her get off that easy. "What is going on?" she asks. Lucy tries to brush it off, but Meryl has known her since the brownies, and Lucy hasn't cried the whole time she's known her, except tonight and when Bush won. Lucy sniffs, "Which Bush?" And Meryl laughs. "Well, both of them, so I guess you've cried twice." They sit together on the stoop, and Lucy tells her friend that this is a different George, and it's not supposed to be like this. Meryl puts her arms around her friend and tells her, "Maybe it is. Maybe it's like the philosopher Yogi Nirmasamnani says, only that which is the other gives you fully onto yourself. And I had to fight for Tom, and it's the best thing I ever did." Just then, Tom pops his head out the second-story window and asks if everything's okay. And Meryl's demeanor changes as she yells back, "Not now! Everything's not about you!" He quietly disappears back into the building as she continues to comfort her friend. The next day, back at Wade Enterprises, a number of the staff are in the break room. It's Lucy's going-away party, and everyone is happily enjoying cake. Norman stands at the front of the room and has an announcement. He asks Lucy to join him because he wrote her a poem. She stands there uncomfortably as he reads, "A rolling stone gathers no moss, so you're leaving with your antacids and floss. Our hair perhaps we will toss, but we are all at a loss because you are the world's best boss."
Aww.
Everyone claps, and she tells him that it was a very nice speech that he's made, and she's really going to miss everyone here at Wade, and there's 1 million memories that are made. She begins to chuckle because she realizes she's starting to rhyme and adds emphatically, "And if you ever get accused of murder, I will be at legal aid." She looks around the room expectantly, but no one's laughing. Oh, well.
I think it's a little too close to home. They're like,
"Yeah,
I've been plotting for a while now."
People start filing out saying goodbye when June finds her. Tells her, "Thank you for everything you've taught me, and I'm really sorry about last night. That was kind of awkward." Lucy scoffs, "Oh, that's fine. I was having a good time with Brian." And June's bitchiness starts coming to the surface. And she says, "Oh, I thought it was Barry." To which Lucy backpedals and says, "Oh, well, first it was Barry, and then it was Brian. You know, whatever." June chuckles at the obvious lie. While Lucy changes the subject by grabbing the stapler, to which bitchy June emerges again and says sweetly, "Oh, isn't that the company property?" Lucy cannot believe she's making this argument, but gives it back to June and says, "Okay, fine, keep it, whatever." June has it back and says, "Oh, you know, it's fine. Go ahead, you take it. It'll be our little secret."
Gross.
Lucy tucks it back into her box of personal items and says, "I probably earned it since, you know, I've been working here 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's normal hours when you work with George." "Wow," June says, "that must make you a workaholic." "And I could totally be a workaholic, but that's why I'm very vigilant about separating my personal and professional life."
Ooh,
Lucy contain herself anymore and says, "Oh, yeah, I bet you can. That must explain the late night meeting in your slip." The claws have come out, and June yanks back the stapler and says, "I beg your pardon. That's absolutely none of your business." They get into a Yankee match over the stapler, which turns more serious and almost comes to blows, but Norman and George separate them. George drags Lucy off as she clacks the stapler at June and then runs her finger across the neck in the "you're dead" motion. They go into the break room and he asks, "What the hell was that?" And Lucy shrugs, "Part of a new office supply strip search?" She asks if he still plans on knocking down the community center, and he tells her that he's been trying to call, but she wants none of it. She just repeats, "Are you planning on knocking down the community center?" He gets frustrated at her lack of response and says, "Are you capable of talking about anything that has to do with your personal life? Let me remind you, you came to the hotel. I was with June. We were unusually dressed. You must have some feelings about that." She snorts. She doesn't have to listen to this, but before she leaves, asks him where he comes off, because, "I didn't take this job to sleep with you. I took this job for a cause." He explodes, "You are a cause. You make Gandhi look like a used car salesman." She retorts, "I can't believe how easy you're being on yourself. You promised me a community center and you didn't deliver." George realizes this and apologizes, but he couldn't control the economy, his brother, and he's not perfect like her. And maybe that's why all her boyfriends left, because she's too perfect. Nobody likes getting preached to. Maybe that's why they ran off as fast as their Birkenstocks could carry them, because she constantly acts like a saint. Ooh. And saints are boring.
Oof.
Lucy's face falls, and they stand there quietly until somebody opens the door to the break room and informs George that Howard needs to see him. And he leaves her there with a broken heart and the shitty residue to his nasty words.
Ugh. Can I just say that fucking George, he's like, "I need to tell you that me and June didn't have sex." And she's like, "That's a moot point for me unless you've actually stepped up to the plate and done what you said you were going to do and save the fucking community center." And he's like, "It's about your feelings. You're just jealous, basically." And she's like, "No, this is a non-starter. Even though I may have feelings about that, you need to answer me whether you're going to save the community center or not. Because if you aren't, I don't care. You go and fuck whoever you want, because I don't want to be in a relationship with you.
All I want is a fucking community center.
Seriously.
You fuck whoever you want. I fucking want the community center.
This isn't about June, even though I hate her. But still.
We all do. We all hate June.
We're firmly on
Lucy's
side.
She's conniving and manipulative.
Yes. Super conniving and manipulative. Oh, when she goes up to
dog again.
Fucking Lucy, and she's like, "George invited me to the gala or whatever," and I'm like, "No, he just casually said, 'Hey, you want to come along? A bunch of us are going.'" There's a big difference between implying that you're his date. Fucking frucker. That's what I have to say.
We talked about this at length before we even started the podcast. Yes. So thankfully, Corinne got a lot of it out of her system, or else this might have gone on for another 20 minutes.
In a Corinne-style tirade, yes.
I didn't want to say it, but since you did, yes, a Corinne-style tirade.
So Lucy, having lost her corporate apartment along with her corporate job, she is now living at home with her parents until she figures out where to go from there. She's done with protesting. She's given up hope and believes that really she's best suited to hanging out in her parents' kitchen eating Chinese food. But she does have a job now, one at the legal aid office.
Ooh. I have a question, because, you know, I'm obsessed with real estate.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, since she had a corporate apartment, that they charged her rent? Or does she just get the corporate apartment as a perk on top of her $250,000?
It's a perk.
Salary. Oh, my God. So not only does she not pay rent for an awesome apartment, she makes $250,000 a year. That would corrupt the fuck out of me. I don't know if I would be able to keep my ground and my morals or something like that. Jesus Christ.
The problem with those kinds of situations is then you're kind of stuck there, because even if you want to leave, you've got this really sweet situation, which makes it more difficult for you to leave. So, yeah.
She also made $250,000.
Oh, no. I would just be stuffing that in the mattress. And then I would be like buying something, because 250,000 times 4 years is $1 million. Thank you very much. I know there's taxes coming out of that, but still, I'm just saying you could sock away quite a bit of money.
Exactly. Ugh. Not stuck there as much as somebody who has to quit their part-time job that has two kids and no executive apartment.
Later at the legal aid office, Lucy's helping somebody with an eviction and goes to fetch some paperwork when George Wade walks in. Polly St. Clair is there and greets him. "Remember me?" George looks at her blankly. "You interviewed me? You thought I was having a baby?" George bumbles, "Oh, right, yeah. How are you? Polly lets him know that she's pregnant, and this time he puts his foot into it by not believing her. Fortunately, this time he's saved from the awkward situation by seeing Lucy enter the room, and he leaves Polly to go talk to Lucy. George, who has come from giving a speech at the building site in front of the community center, says to Lucy, who is actively ignoring him, "I think I may have blown my first speech that I've written entirely by myself. Tell me what you think." Lucy continues walking around and shuffling papers as he essentially says that Wade Enterprises will keep the community center because he said so and wants to keep a promise. He then starts talking about how the woman he's keeping the promise to is much like the community center. Lucy turns around and stares at him, and he continues, "A little rough around the edges, but once you look closer, absolutely beautiful and the only one of her kind. And even though I've said cruel things and driven her away, she's become the voice in my head." Lucy's eyes well up with emotion, and he says, "And I can't seem to drown her out, and I don't want to drown her out. So we are going to keep the community center because I gave my word to her, and because we gave our word to the community." She smiles happily, and he breaks out of his speech to say, "And I didn't sleep with June. That's not part of the speech, but I wanted to make sure you were aware of that important fact." He pauses, and when Lucy doesn't say anything, he says, "So, what do you think?" And she responds, "I have to get back to work." George is surprised, but apologizes for intruding and gracefully leaves. Polly and her other coworker, who have witnessed the entire thing, shake their heads in disappointment. Once he's gone, Lucy sits next to Polly and says, "Aside from that split infinitive, somewhere in the middle..." I have no idea what a split infinitive is. Do you?
No. And I was like, "What?" I actually, every time I hear that, want to go back and see what a split infinitive is and then just lose interest quickly because who cares?
Yeah. Because grammar.
Yeah.
"That speech was quite perfect, wasn't it?" Polly agrees. "Yeah, I don't know what the hell you're still doing here, and I don't even like him." And with that, Lucy rushes out the door. She looks around and finally sees him. "George!" she yells. He stops, turns around, and she runs into his arms. And this would be perfect, except then she apologizes for being herself and says she can tone herself down. Mm. And he physically closes her lips together with his fingers to keep her from talking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then he redeems himself a bit by looking into her eyes with heart eyes. "Lucy, I'm in love with you." She stares back at him with hard eyes. "I'm in love with you, too." She slowly goes in for a kiss when George interrupts it, startling Lucy. "I should mention that I've resigned and am now poor. And when I say poor, it means that we may have to share a helicopter with another family. Does that work for you?" Lucy smiles softly. "As long as I don't have to work for you, we will be fine." And with that cleared up, George states romantically, "And now I'd very much like to discuss the whole Bobcat pretzel thing." Lucy chuckles. "I'm allergic to Bobcats, but I can do the pretzel." He says, "Excellent." And they finally kiss. And it's halfway decent dry kiss that is made more romantic by the camera slowly swirling around them.
Yep.
Next, we see Lucy and George at her parents' apartment. She's ordering Chinese food while he marvels at how small the apartment is. But at the end of the order, Lucy can finally say she's ordering for two, even though she seems to be ordering the same amount or even maybe less food than she was previously. And the movie ends with "Pay Paradise, Put Up a Parking Lot" playing over the closing credits. The end.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? Pay paradise to put up a parking lot.
So, Miss Tamara, what did you think of 2 weeks? Notice, soda, 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 soda.
I love this movie. I love it for the clever one-liners and Hugh Grant, who... besides being very problematic in many areas, is just charming as fuck in these fucking movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm going to give it 4 dry kisses. 4 because it's just one of my tried and true favorite rom-com movies. I love the banter between George and Lucy. I love how the good kind of prevails at the end when you don't think it will and it surprises you. Mm-hmm. I'm knocking it down a dry kiss because of the stuff that it says circa 2002 that kind of craptastic ending when she apologizes, he closes her lips, and then the kiss was kind of like anticlimactic for me because I was waiting the whole time for them to kiss, and it was slightly better than when she kissed him on the boat and then passed out during the kiss.
Yeah.
And the diversity's meh. But yeah, no, this is still one of my favorite. I still watch it over and over again. Did not get sick of it, and it's probably like the umpteenth time I've watched this movie, but still love it after all these years. And the fact that I hate June so much still that I seethe with rage when I see her on the screen, even now. So the characters are awesome. Still resonates with me deep, deep in my heart. How many dry kisses do you give it, Corinne?
I give it 3 dry kisses. A solid 3 dry kisses. It's a good movie, but the whole end, like, the end was good until she apologizes for being herself and says she can learn and she can tone herself down. And he physically closes her mouth. Ugh. Ugh. The diversity sucked in this. He had a driver who was black and they had some nice little conversations. But honestly, not at all integral to the plot. Could easily take it out. And there was Polly St. Clair, who was an awesome feature in this movie. And she was black, but she was in just very small scenes.
I was kind of disappointed because, like, Polly St. Clair, she was interviewing for the position that pays $250,000 a year. And she was a candidate and a good candidate. And I was like, but did you really botch that interview? Or is she really bad at interviews? Because then she went back to Legal Aid, which is like the kind of bottom paying rung of the ladder if you're a lawyer.
Oh, I know. I was wondering that too. On top of it, if I were Polly St. Clair, I'd be like, and now you owe me that job because guess who said I was pregnant? Yeah. That would be you. I'm a lawyer. Yeah.
If not the first time, the second time when he sees her and says that she's not pregnant. All right, bitch, now you have to hire me. You don't get the shit suit out of you. Hire me.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe she was a contender until June came along. So June with her flaming red hair and her devious, devious ways.
Of course.
And June is in a lot of Hallmark movies and she's in one of my favorite Hallmark movies. But I don't know if I can show it to Tamara because she might just rip poor little June's heart out, Alicia Witt, because she may be unfairly biased against her because of how strongly she feels about her in this movie.
Totally. Happens to me all the time. When I have a really set opinion of somebody's character from one movie, it often paints the way I feel about them in a different movie. And I cannot help that. I'm working on it. But too soon. Too soon.
But the movie that I love her in the most is The Mistletoe Inn. It's one of my favorite Hallmark movies. And she plays a person who has been working on a kind of novel for a while. And her boyfriend dumps her because he wants only serious writers in his life. And she ends up going to this writing retreat and ends up, like, kind of finding herself along the way. And it's a really lovely story. But still, probably too soon for Tamara. But I mean, Hugh Grant was lovely. Sandra Bullock, great. She is such a great, not only is she a great comedic actress, she's a great physical comedian. When she was drunk and she, like, fucking falls down the stairs in the yacht and she, like, kind of saves herself and the drink. Incredible. So
I think that this movie was delightful, but it had some things missing in it for me, including the lack of diversity. But they tried, which was better than, you know, say Serendipity. I have such a soft spot for Serendipity, though. But
And just because they paved Paradise to put up a parking lot, those bastards.
I know. I do like how, in the end, good prevails this one time.
Somebody actually does what they say they're going to do.
Yay! So, Miss Tamara, what do we have coming up next week?
Well, we have a double feature. Ooh. Via Sandra Bullock, because next week we're doing Practical Magic.
Oh, we're shifting into the month of October. And this year we're making things instead of October bare-chested. Because Hallmark doesn't have any Halloween movies, we are making things Halloween-y? I don't know.
Spooktacular.
Thank you.
When you hear that heavy breathing, that's Melody adding her 2 cents to the October spooktacular. Help me get it closer. Do it. Do your heavy breathing. The call is coming from inside the house. Well, great, Melody. She sniffed the microphone, and then I pulled it away, and then she started heavy breathing again. Whatever. Oh, thank you, Melody, for breathing heavy into the microphone.
I totally adore this movie so much. It's a little bit spooky, but not too scary, which is good for me because I'm a big fraidy cat. And it's got Nicole Kidman in it and Sandra Bullock. And is there one more sister?
No.
Okay. It's got Nicole Kidman in it and Sandra Bullock, and they are fantastic together. So good. If you have anything you'd like to say about A September to Remember, 2 weeks notice, Sandra Bullock, Practical Magic, any of that stuff, you can email us at onedrykiss@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us via the social medias, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at One Dry Kiss.
And as always, if you'd like and can find the time, we'd love to see your ratings and reviews anywhere you might listen to this podcast. But for now, we'd just like to thank you for stopping by, and we bid you adieu with one dry kiss. Mwah! See you next time.
See you next time.
In the words of Tamara, Tamara, Tamara.
I'm still trying to find my place.
And now we have a soundtrack to finding your place. Soundtracks to everything.